This is Brian Cambria with news for the KVNF listening area, Thursday morning, December 27th, 2012. Democratic state lawmaker Mark Ferrandino will make history next legislative session by becoming Colorado's first gay Speaker of the House. Benta Berkland sat down with him to discuss his priorities for the season, for the session, I should say, and his new role.
Speaker-designee Mark Ferrandino, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
First, I want to ask, do you feel any additional pressure coming in as Speaker and then also being the first gay Speaker the state's ever had?
I feel a lot of pressure given just the enormity of the role and the responsibility of becoming Speaker of the House. Being the first gay Speaker, you know, I don't think that that's, you know, a fact of what the position is. Being able to be the Speaker and have that responsibility, no matter if I was the first gay Speaker, if I was, you know, any individual coming into this office, there's a huge responsibility on my shoulders. And, you know, I take that very seriously and really want to, over the next 2 years, build upon the work we've been pushing over the last couple of years and really solve some of the big problems we face in our state.
Is there a certain type of leadership style you're hoping to have?
My philosophy in governing is cooperation. Really getting people to a table and sitting around that table and talking about what is the goals we're trying to accomplish, what are the values that we bring to the table. Most of the time, if you can get people to sit down and talk about an issue and talk about what they're trying to achieve, you can find the right policy priorities and policy outcomes that actually achieve those goals that you can get a consensus around. So how do you do that? How do you bring everyone around a table, talk about the policies, and get compromise? That's what the legislature is supposed to do. We haven't seen that much in Washington. In Colorado, actually, we've seen it more often than not. I want to continue that. I want to make sure that some of the big issues we have to tackle are done in both a bipartisan fashion and with all the different interested parties.
Can you just point to some of the big issues and some of the sticking points you think lawmakers will be grappling with?
You know, the biggest issue, of course, as we always deal with, is the budget and the long-term structural issues. The governor's final report from TBD Colorado just came out and talked about how we have a structural budget problem that needs to be addressed. I hope we can find a solution where both Democrats and Republicans come together and say, we need to make the key investments in our state, especially in our P20 education system. We also have issues around oil and gas. The Colorado Oil and Gas Commission is working on some rules. Hopefully they can come to a good compromise there. But if not, I think the legislature will have to look at the issues.
With oil and gas, are you referring to just setback distances from drilling wells to homes and schools?
You know, I think that's the most contentious issue right now that the commission is looking at. Hopefully they can come up with a good compromise. But I know there's a lot in my caucus and a lot in the legislature in both parties who are concerned and have constituents concerned about oil and gas exploration as it moves into the metro area. You know, we also, you know, have issues around jobs in the economy. We are seeing a recovery take hold. Colorado is in a good position to recover, but we can't sit on our laurels and allow the economy to continue the way it is. We need to see how we can make those key investments to ensure that we're growing the economy at a faster pace. We're in this state have a limited economic development budget, but we can use it wiser and better than any other state. And so we need to work on that and try and do that. So, you know, those are some probably the key issues. The other one, education. The governor's budget proposal starts to stop digging the hole we've done in K-12 funding over the last couple of years and starts to put a little more money in there. Our priority as the Democratic caucus is to try and put as much money we can to K-12 education. And we're going to continue to push for that through the legislative session.
Great. I think that's all we have time for. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
That was Speaker-designee Mark Ferrandino. I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
Distilleries producing spirits like gin and vodka are popping up all across the United States. In Colorado, the growth is particularly notable. The number of distilleries has grown from just 2 to nearly 40 in less than a decade. Those in the business attribute the growth to a culture that embraces local, handcrafted booze. State laws free of red tape also help. One of the state's newest distilleries is perhaps its highest at 6,600 feet above sea level. The distillery, near Aspen, is producing vodka from locally grown potatoes. From Aspen Public Radio, Marcy Krivenin reports.
Let's start over on this end.
Mark Kleckner of Woody Creek Distillers chats with workers in a huge, spotless production room. Christmas music accompanies the team as they clean machines and process alcohol. This is where the distillery's signature product, potato vodka, is made.
It's laid out very nicely for the production flow, where raw materials basically come in here. They work their way across as we strip and rectify the alcohol, and then the bottling and barrel storage is on the other side of the building.
Before the finished product reaches a bottle, the vodka starts as a potato in the field.
We grew probably close to 500,000 pounds of potatoes on the 30 acres up in Woody Creek, and it took us the better part of 3 months to process those potatoes.
A machine washes, scrubs, and peels the potatoes. The end product is a huge bin of mashed potatoes, the basis for vodka. The remainder of the vodka-making process involves meticulous attention by this man.
David Matthews, I'm the distillery manager.
I sort of look after the day-to-day stuff, making the spirits.
Matthews is in charge of turning the mashed potato substance into spirits through a scientific process that involves converting starch to sugar, adding yeast, and stripping away alcohol in a set of huge copper stills.
There are two tall columns in the center there. We use those for rectification. They have between them 42 bubble plates. And before I start getting any spirit off the still, I need to fill the bubble plates completely. So it takes a little while, but it's worth it.
The distillery will start selling its potato vodka early next year at its tasting room and in local liquor stores. Spirits like apple brandy and gin will also be produced there. The Basalt-based distillery is one of a growing number of micro-distilleries in Colorado.
We are one of the top states out of the country as far as distilleries go. And as far as distilleries per capita, we're definitely high.
Rob Masters is president of the Colorado Distillers Guild. On the Front Range, he says distilleries operate from Fort Collins to Colorado Springs, and on the Western Slope, spirits are being made in places like Palisade and Grand Junction. He says the growth is due to a culture that developed with microbreweries, which popularized local handcrafted beer. Also, he says state laws are friendly here, allowing tasting rooms and storefront distribution.
We're very fortunate in Colorado because the laws have been kind of laid out for us by the brewers and the wineries over the last 10, 20 years. And so because of that, distilling has really taken off.
This is the signature vodka.
Back at Woody Creek Distillers, Mark Kleckner pours crystal clear vodka into a glass.
If you smell, it's got a very pleasant nose to it.
Kleckner's especially proud of the local products in his spirits, potatoes from up the road and pears from Peonia. He thinks this local connection sets his facility apart in an ever-growing field of distilleries.
You know, I think the whole crafted cocktail boom that's happening right now, you know, they're looking for unique, new, high-quality ingredients for cocktails, and I think it's tied to people's desire to want a high-quality product that they know where it came from and they know what it's made of, and that's exactly what we are.
When it opens, the distillery plans to distribute 10,000 cases of its booze. That's a lot of potatoes, considering 10 to 15 pounds of spuds go into just one bottle of vodka. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Mercy Grivenin.
For many in southern Colorado, the Arkansas River is the lifeblood of healthy communities. But the region suffered through this year's extreme and exceptional drought conditions. As KRCC's Andrea Chalfin reports, all along the Arkansas River, people are in some ways holding their breaths to see what this winter brings.
I'm standing here on the banks of the river at the Arkansas Headwaters Recreation Area Visitor Center in Salida. It's a bright sunny day, but the temperatures are around 30 degrees. Portions of the river are covered in very thin layers of ice, with water bubbling through holes in the sheer surface. but mostly the water flows freely downstream.
A good snow year is very important to us, not only for the river, but also for, you know, the farmers and everyone else who depends so much on water.
Rob White is a park manager at the recreation area. While the current flow of the river there is about average, during the summer, White says portions of the popular rafting destination were barely boatable.
In an extremely dry year like we had in 2012, there's not enough water to go around. Obviously, there wasn't enough water for the farmers. You know, there wasn't enough water for the irrigators. And so we also had to make do with a smaller amount of water.
Typically, the snow-to-water equivalency in the Arkansas River Basin approaches around 5 inches by mid-December. Right now, it's only 57% of average. With so much riding on this year's snowpack, the numbers are disturbing for farmers downstream who depend on the river for irrigation.
You look toward the hills, you see the weather reports. If there's water or snowpack in the hills, and you try to make plans accordingly.
Mike Bartolo is a research manager for Colorado State University in Rocky Ford.
So you try to know how much fertilizer you need to order or how much seed you need to order, but you really don't know because it's so tentative.
2012 got off to a promising start along the Arkansas River, but things gradually got worse. A lack of rainfall didn't help the alfalfa and corn crops that are predominant here. One gauge in Rocky Ford shows less than 5 inches of total precipitation. 78-year-old John Schweitzer and his family farm hay near Rocky Ford.
If you don't get the snow and get the runoff, you can't depend on it raining either. It might, and it could, but you don't know that. And if we go through the winter like it is now, I doubt if there will be much activity at all.
But it's not all doom and gloom. Farmers like Schweitzer are by nature optimistic.
And we got all winter yet. You know, this is early. So we got, you know, we're not panicking yet because it can change overnight. We've seen it do it many times. And so we just have to go along with it and have faith enough to think that it's going to get better.
And in the upper Arkansas River Valley in Salida, park manager Rob White has a similar outlook.
A lot can happen between now and May 15th when we start to experience runoff. I think what's really important is that we get those snowstorms that we typically get in the spring months.
Despite the optimism, a recent seasonal outlook from the Climate Prediction Center at the National Weather Service says drought conditions are likely to persist or even intensify through next March. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Andrea Chalfin in Colorado Springs.
Thus concludes today's newscast. I'm Brian Cambria for KVNF News.